Hey, good morning and welcome to Ag in Uncertain Times, a webinar series. Presentations intended to assist agricultural professionals, extension educators, and practitioners prepare for the challenges developing in agriculture. Today's webinar will cover three different speakers. Your MC for today is me. I'm George Haynes, an agricultural policy specialist at Montana State. I'll serve as your host for today's webinar, but I'm only able to do this through the help and assistance of many others that are sitting behind the scenes here to make these presentations possible. Our team members come from a number of Western states, and without their support and the support of the institutions, these webinar offerings wouldn't happen. So I really appreciate all the involvement of the people that are sitting behind the stage to make sure this works. I'll get caught up on my slides here. We have three distinguished speakers for today. The first of them, Martha Sullins. Martha's an Ag Business Management Specialist at Colorado State University. The second of our speakers is Karen Allen, Assistant Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics, and Food Sciences at Utah State University. And our third speaker for today is Shermaine Hardesty. Shermaine is an extension economist in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at University of California, Davis, and a director of the University of California's Small Farms Program. We'll have much more in-depth introductions of each of the candidates as we proceed along here, but just to introduce you to our distinguished set of panelists for today. First, let me explain how the participants in the webinar can put questions to our speakers. The process we'll follow is to enter any questions into the chat window you find at the lower left side of your screen. You might locate that, the chat window on the lower left. Once you've typed in your questions and click the button to the right, on the right-hand side of the box, to submit it, it will be conveyed to our background team. These folks will organize the questions and feed them to me as the moderator to present them to the speakers at the appropriate times. And we'll see how the time goes, but I'll typically ask a question or two right after you're finished, and then we'll have a little kind of a panel session at the end of this. Again, it all depends on how much time we have. We'd also like to encourage you that if you're experiencing any difficulties participating in the webinar, whether audio or for some other issue, you may also let us know through the chat window, and then we can help correct that for you. One of our team members has a technical expertise, and we also have other people with subject matter knowledge that can help move us through this. So, okay. Finally, before we begin the first session of this webinar, we would like to point out that if you're having trouble viewing the online slide material, you may click the full screen button to toggle the slides to fill the entire screen on your machine. Clicking it again will reveal the chat window and the slide materials in a side-by-side format, so you can just have a little bit bigger picture to look at. So we have a few questions for you here. First of those is up, so please tell us about yourself and what is your primary occupation. And in this particular poll, you can click all that apply. So if you're interested in one or more than one of those categories, you can let us know. Okay, so it looks like we have a number of extension educators on today, two agricultural producers. Okay, the second of these, where is your main place of business located? Just check one of those, if you will. Looks like about two-thirds of us are in the western part of the U.S. Okay, thirdly, which of the following best describes your situation? And again, if you could just click one of those, that would be good. Okay. And then lastly, this is really important for webinars, so you never know how many people are in the room, but this gives you a chance to answer that. So how many individuals are participating in the webinar from your home office location? seems like nearly all of us are just one person would be in the participating this morning.
Okay.
All right. So thanks for your response to those poll questions. And we'll be loading up our first set of slides here. Okay, our first presentation this morning, as the slides are loading, is Martha Sullins. Martha is an ag business management specialist with Colorado State University Extension, where her areas of emphasis in applied research and outreach include smaller scale and specialty livestock and crop production businesses, agritourism, local foods, farm transition, on-farm food safety and risk management. Her presentation for today is local foods in the West. And with that, Martha, you're up to bat.
Great. Thank you very much, George. Well, I would like to start today by just providing an overview of local foods in the West and talk about what those food systems are, some of the drivers in the market for local foods, and then what we see in terms of growth and evolving opportunity for producers. And the most important thing to note is that as we look across federal, academic, and other sources of information, there just is no one definition of what local or local foods is. And some definitions come up as being very specific to a geographic distance of 50 or 100 miles. Others refer to a larger area. But in the final analysis, although this is a really important concept, there is just no specific definition. And that's important because in a lot of markets, there is a very observable premium for local foods, but there's really no way to certify what is local unless that particular marketplace has a program where they do define local very specifically. So local food systems, though, are considered place-specific clusters of agricultural producers and the consumers who are engaged in production, processing, distribution, and sales of those foods. And I draw that definition from the Economic Research Service in a publication that they released last year. Another important consideration is what is driving demand in local food markets. And so as you can see from the graphic on this slide, if you look at the legends there, you can see there are a lot of attributes listed. And this is from a 2008 study from Onozaka Nurse and Filmini McFadden. And you can see that some of those attributes listed are that purchasing local foods in direct markets provides health benefits, supports the local economy, helps farmers receive a fair share of returns. But what you don't see listed are the more commonly noted attributes such as price, convenience, packaging that we might see in more conventional markets. So note that these are all very much values-based attributes, and what they really tell us is that consumers believe that by making these purchases, they're supporting a cause, they're driving something in the marketplace. Another study from 2015 just substantiates that 93% of consumers associate local with fresh. So again, there was no mention of local meaning those more specific attributes. So let's look then at what we know about size and growth in direct markets. And there really is a dearth of data. So you'll notice as I go through this that there we've got some national data, and then we're going to have to look at regional information and kind of pull together some different sources to see what the trends are. At the national level, I'll go back to that Economic Research Survey study that I mentioned just a minute ago. They did a very nice job of in putting together what they call synthetic estimates of the total value of local food based on U.S. Census of Agriculture data as well as Ag Resource Management Survey data, which is also known as ARMS, found that the total value could be estimated at $6.1 billion in 2012. So, of course, that's increased since then. That value comes out as being certainly higher than the Census of Agriculture estimate. segments and much lower than what we see in the grocery or industry literature or reports that have been released. So now we'll look at what we can pull from other data sources about regional direct market growth and dynamics, again, because we just don't have the level of data needed to be able to make specific projections. So if we look at this heat map, it shows us the location of farmers markets, which are a primary direct market channel. And this shows you across the United States, you can see those bright red spots are where there's a greater concentration of farmers markets. You can see they occur primarily in greater density in the eastern third of the U.S. as well as along the coastal western states. The location of these markets is really important because they serve as a point of contact or a point of entry for a lot of local food producers. It's where they really learn how to gauge and build a local food-based business. Farmers markets also serve as food incubators, as business incubators, especially for new and beginning farmers. So the fact that we have areas where there are fewer of those direct market opportunities should be noted. What's also interesting is that the growth in farmers markets, while it accelerated a lot through the mid-2000s, we're now seeing that that growth appears to be tapering off a bit. And this has been noted in other studies for sure, although there's still a large number of farmers markets, both in the U.S. as well as in the western states. We're seeing that the growth in those markets is not as steep as it was before. In fact, it's really leveled off. So I think we're seeing a bit of a saturation in that direct market opportunity. What we are seeing is that the number of subscription agriculture service farms, so CSA farms, which are another really important type of direct market activity for local food producers, that it grew very quickly, according to U.S. Census of Agriculture data, in the West, so by 11%, while that growth was much smaller across the United States. So this does provide that direct market connection for local food producers, but it has at what we recognize to be lower costs in a lot of areas. And so I think what we're starting to see is some migration from farmers markets, which tend to, where producers tend to incur much higher transportation and labor costs, to on-farm-based direct market sales, which will have lower costs in those areas. So what we suspect, then, is that the local food market is shifting more into intermediated markets. And so these are not direct-to-consumer markets, but rather they are markets where there is an intermediary who's facilitating that sale. And so I have listed a couple of those. Food hubs and food aggregators are emerging as a really important intermediated market, and food hubs are collaborative enterprises that help move local foods into larger markets and by aggregating and distributing products across both small and mid-sized producers and across multiple growers. So that allows those growers to access larger markets than they could otherwise individually. Farm to school and other institutions also, as well as sales to other retail buyers. So those are what we see as the emerging intermediate market. So this map shows that Western region farms, and there are two data points hopefully you can see on here. And one, you can see the colored squares show by county areas that have different levels of farms that have reported through the Census of Agriculture that they sell in intermediated markets. And so from the yellow, where there's very little activity, to the dark blue, where there's more activity, you can see that a lot of that, again, is located in the coastal states. The red dots are the food hubs, which are the food aggregation points. So overall, ERS estimated in 2012, because they were able to do this at a national level, but not at a state level, they were able to estimate that $3.3 billion of the $6.1 billion that I mentioned before, so a little more than half, is attributable to intermediated marketing channels only. So it's actually a really important market. What is difficult about this is we just don't have enough data to understand the dynamics. data, and this is just the number of farms that report either direct to consumer or direct to retail, which is also intermediated markets. And you can see that there's a greater proportion of Western farms using direct to consumer markets than in the U.S., and a little bit higher proportion using direct to retail. And this is really the only information that we have from the U.S. Census of Agriculture data. We have nothing on value of sales going through intermediated markets. This is about to change, which is really exciting, and I will mention that in the conclusion to this part of the presentation. So we can look then at the location of food hubs. Here's another map that shows that indeed we do have food hubs dispersed throughout the West. But again, you can see that there are areas where there are none of these aggregation centers. And these really do represent an important opportunity for producers, especially those that are geographically challenged, as many of our food producers are. They're removed from direct markets. It allows them to sell to a localized aggregator. They can still capture more of that local food premium, but they don't incur the cost of marketing. Those are borne by the aggregator. Food hubs preserve the identity of the product generally as it moves through the food supply chain from production all the way through to distribution to the end buyer. So a very important intermediated market, and it's growing very quickly in the West, according to the latest U.S. Farm to School Census data, is farm to school. And these are purchases by schools or school districts directly from food producers. And these are purchases of fruits, vegetables, meats, and dairy. And you can see that the value, and this is in real terms, was $110 million in 2011-2012 when they conducted the first census. It grew to $245 million, so it doubled, more than doubled, in 2015. And you can see this is the percentage by state represented on this chart. So this gives you a sense of the untapped potential as we try to get a handle on local food markets. And I just put this slide in here to give you a sense of, in kind of a broad sense of, if we look at this map, which this chart, which shows food away food at home expenditures as being about $2,200 per person in the United States in 2012, compared to what farmers reported selling to consumers, those are the blue bars, you can see that there is definitely a lot of room for growth in this area. So then let's look at the supply side a little bit using the data that we have available. And we know across the West as well as throughout the United States, overall, direct-to-consumer food sales, and again, where we have that value of sales that we can measure from one census year to the next, that is a very small percentage still of all the market value of agricultural products in the United States. There are a few exceptions in Western states where we see that that has grown dramatically as a portion, as a proportion, but overall it's less than 1%, and that has changed very little overall. And so if we look at the supply side again, we can see that really the evidence points to the growth in local foods is not necessarily in those direct-to-consumer markets, because it does appear to be tapering off. I listed on the right there some of the top markets where we see the greatest value in terms of total value of direct-to-consumer sales. But overall, we can see that that growth appears to be waning a little bit. However, on the other hand, what we see is that the number of direct market farms is growing in the United States and throughout the West. And what's interesting about this is that while there are more farms, those farms are not producing in a larger sales category. And so what is also consistent with what ERS found is that those farms are selling. ERS found, for example, that farms with less than $75,000 in gross cash income made up 85% of all local food farms. And what we see looking at the census data is that the growth in those direct-to-consumer or local food farms has really been in those lower sales categories. So there's a lot of growth, but it's not impactful in terms of total local food sales. So what I think is important to look at now is what is really behind the growth of the local food economy in the West. And there are a couple of really important issues here. And one is there are a lot of innovative projects and partnerships that have emerged. There's some really new and exciting market information that helps to decrease transaction costs and increase efficiency in these markets. And there have been some really significant public policy changes and investments made that are facilitating growth in these markets. And as we gather more data and information, those investments and that market information is being channeled into the areas where we see this great need. Here is an example of what we're seeing a new growth in, and that is regional food cooperatives. We're really seeing a resurgence in cooperatives across the West and across the U.S. And this is just an example of a cooperative south of Portland that's a multi-stakeholder organization that encompasses producers, consumers, and workers as part and members of this cooperative. And so they all hold pieces of this value chain from production through to distribution and purchase by the end buyer. We're also seeing a lot of innovative production facilities that are helping to increase both the availability of local foods as well as the types of foods that are that can be purchased. The top two slides show a vertical production facility, an indoor production facility in Jackson, Wyoming, that's a greenhouse on the side of a parking garage. The lower two slides are a hydroponics operation in western Colorado, and that is one area, an aquaponics rather, where we are seeing a lot of growth because they use 90% less land and water than conventional production systems. And so we're seeing a lot of emerging aquaponics operations in the West. In terms of the financial backing and investment in local food businesses, we're seeing a lot of community-based investing, and this is just an example of La Montanita has a micro-lending program where they lend to farms and ranches and value-added producers who sell products within what they consider their food shed, and so they make small loan funds available. We also see retailers doing this. Whole Foods has a local producer loan program, and we also see loan programs emerging where smaller investors are bundling capital together to invest in food businesses that otherwise wouldn't be able to obtain capital through conventional means. A lot of new market information and tools, thanks primarily to the USDA Ag Marketing Service. You can see there's price information on farmers markets and auctions, farm-to-school programs, food hubs. Price and other information is coming, and so they're doing a really good job of putting together information that can help buyers understand dynamics in the marketplace. They also just facilitated the development of a local food systems toolkit, which helps communities conduct economic impact analyses and understand linkages in their community food systems so they can be more involved participants and drivers. And lastly, in terms of investment, USDA has invested about $1 billion in the last 6 years in local and regional food businesses, and the 2014 Farm Bill alone authorized $429 million for different local food projects. And so these next couple of slides show you what that federal investment looks like across the West, and this shows you the number of projects that were funded per state, and this comes from USDA information for that time period, 2009 to 2015. And then this shows you what that investment looks like in terms of the total value of the $185 million that's been invested in Western states for those past 6 years. So, and that represents about 32% of the total investment that the USDA made in across the United States. That was in the West. So then lastly, just a few resources to point you to, and I will just mention one in particular, which is really exciting, and that's right there in the middle. The National Ag Statistics Service is in the process of conducting its first local food marketing practices survey. The survey just went out to over 43,000 producers nationwide. The data were due yesterday, so hopefully a lot of producers have turned in their surveys. The survey results will be available in December, and that information is going to shed a lot of light on particularly those intermediated sales, which are harder for us to grasp right now. But that is a tool that's going to be extremely helpful in terms of identifying where and the value of local food sales and the cost associated with those sales. So with that, I will turn the microphone over. Thank you very much.
Martha, thank you very much. That was a great introduction to this. These are statistics that I personally have been looking for some time. I'll be really anxious to see what additional information is available with the city survey results. We have several questions here for you, but I think we should move to the next speaker now, and then we will have a panel at the end of the hour here. See how much time we have, and then we will pose these questions, two of these questions to you at that point. So, while those slides are loading, let me introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Karen Allen. Karen's an assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics, and Food Sciences at Utah State University. Dr. Allen has taught the following courses: Culinary Basics, Science of Food Preparation, and Food Technology and Health. In addition to the courses she's taught and her research responsibilities, she is also responsible for the development of extension programming to assist small businesses and entrepreneurs with the production and processing of quality foods. So with that, and as soon as we have the, we'll have some slides here momentarily, really welcome Karen Allen to this webinar this morning, and thanks for agreeing to participate in this. And so, well, we're gradually working our way there.
Hi, thank you. As those slides are loading, I just want to point out, just to throw one more definition of local in. Recently, the Food Safety Modernization Act, we have several pieces of that legislation that have been finalized, and the official FDA definition of local is now 275 miles. Or within the same state. So it's continuing to be muddled what exactly those definitions are. So I will get started with this. Food safety can be a really tough topic to cover in such a short amount of time. So I am going to move through this fairly quickly, but I do have some resources available for you if you have additional questions. So when we talk about value-added foods, one of the most simple ways to define that in some sources is to look at if it's local, if it's some type of a marketing term, if it's organic, vine ripened, a specialty crop. But one of the biggest issues with value-added foods is when people actually want to take that raw agricultural commodity and turn it into a shelf-stable, marketable food product, things like jams, pickled vegetables, herbed vinegar. For all of these things, you have to consider what the regulations are that apply to that specific product, what kind of safety issues you will be facing with that product, and what kind of labeling issues are associated with it. The rest of this presentation, I'm really going to focus on some of the regulatory and safety issues, but if you have labeling questions, there are resources available excuse me, through the FDA. So when we talk about produce, where exactly do we draw the line between what is unprocessed versus what is processed? And a big part of this is going to come down to what the requirements are from the FDA in the piece of the Food Safety Modernization Act titled The Standards for the Growing, Harvesting, Packing, and Holding of Produce for Human Consumption. So the FDA has set some very specific requirements. If you are a farm and you are doing under $25,000 in total produce sales. You do not have to keep these specific records and meet some of the other requirements that this piece of legislation requires. However, be aware that additional state regulations through your Department of Agriculture may apply, not only to unprocessed produce registration. In some states, we do have states that require if you are selling certain types of raw agricultural commodities, you have to be registered with them to do that. There may also be additional requirements through that State Department of Agriculture in terms of what types of handling procedures can be applied to certain produce before it falls into their definition of process. If you are processing any type of raw agricultural commodity into a sellable food product, that does have to be done in an inspected kitchen or facility. So depending on where you look for that definition, anything that has been peeled or cut is going to be considered processed food. Washed leaves a bigger question. It depends on whether you are using a culinary water source. According to the Food Safety Modernization Act, if you are simply washing to remove dirt off of, say, a potato without any kind of extreme scrubbing, that is not necessarily considered processed. However, your State Department of Agriculture may take a different view on that and still require that that activity be conducted in a certified kitchen. If you are adding any type of sanitizer or additive to that wash water, immediately then that would be considered a processed product. Other things, and I get this question all the time, are cut leafy greens. If you are meeting the agricultural water quality standards contained in the Food Safety Modernization Act, just simply the process of cutting those greens and putting them in a bag does not render them processed under that specific piece of legislation. However, we see many states where the State Department of Agriculture does require that this type of activity be conducted in an inspected kitchen. And then dehydrated produce. Obviously, the picture there of the apple rings, that's very clearly processed. You have cut and handled that apple in a way that makes it not in its natural state, and then to the point that you're drying it. If it's something that is dried on the vine, if it is dried herbs, depending on which state you are in, those activities may or may not need to be conducted in an inspected kitchen. So it is always best to check with your State Department of Agriculture to determine exactly how those local inspectors are going to expect you to handle those products. So when you're looking at a processing option, if you need to use a certified kitchen, there are a few different options. One of those is to do those activities in a cottage kitchen. Depending on the type of product that you are making, that may be allowed in your state. Most states do have a formalized cottage food rule. This is in a home kitchen where an inspector may come in and actually inspect that home kitchen. You do not have to register with the FDA for this option, but you have very limited processing options in terms of the kinds of foods that can be produced. Other options include certified commercial facilities. This may be a state or county or local health department inspected kitchen. You would have to register with the FDA depending on the level of food sales and if you are conducting those activities on a farm. And you do have to comply with the Food Safety Modernization Act. The last option on this slide that I've listed is to work with a contract packager. That is an established food facility, say, that makes jams or jellies that takes your raw agricultural commodity, your apples, your strawberries, processes them for you for a fee, and then hands that finished, bottled, labeled, final product to you. In that case, you would have to register with the FDA, but you would not have to worry about the additional registrations or filings that may be required because the contract packager would handle the majority of those. So I want to point out some of the exemptions that are in place under the Food Safety Modernization Act, specifically for small farms. And this can be found in the current Good Manufacturing Practice, Hazard Analysis, and Risk-Based Preventative Controls for Human Food portion of that legislation. Specifically, farms with under $1 million in total food sales are exempt from certain record-keeping requirements that are a part of the Food Safety Modernization Act. Excuse me. I'm suffering with seasonal allergies and it's getting kind of scratchy throat. The definition in this piece of legislation of a farm provides a specific exemption for certain on-farm activities. If you start with, for example, a fruit that has a natural pH of 4.6 or below, and that is processed into a jam, those are exempt from this piece of legislation. Your farm would still be held to the produce rule portion of that of the Food Safety Modernization Act, but you would not be required to register as a food facility with the FDA. Your State Department of Agriculture will most likely require that those activities take place in a certified kitchen. In some cases, you may be able to do those types of activities in a cottage kitchen. Be aware that that $1 million limit, that cap, includes the market value of any food that is processed, packed, or held for profit. This is really going to have a large impact on some of our, for example, our community-supported agriculture or CSA programs, other types of co-ops. If you are aggregating or distributing even raw agricultural commodities, that goes towards that $1 million cap, the value of that product that you are handling. So some examples of exempt activities under this piece of legislation include normal harvesting activities. This would include trimming away, say, on a head of lettuce, the dead or dying or dirty outer leaves. You can sift to remove pebbles or extra dirt. For certain types of raw agricultural commodities, they can also be shelled. And again, you can wash them with culinary water. Drying and dehydrating in some cases is exempt, as is packaging and labeling those raw agricultural commodities. So when you are looking at processing a product and you are in a certified kitchen, you need to consider how you're going to keep that product safe. That includes how you're going to clean and sanitize, how you're going to prepare, package, and display that product, and you do need to look at any type of chemical, physical, or biological source of contamination. That can even include sanitizers, for example, in the chemical contaminants category. The Food Safety Modernization Act focuses pretty specifically on the bacterial or biological sources of contamination, and those include bacteria. These are things like salmonella, E. coli, and listeria. We've seen a lot of produce that has been recalled in recent years as a result of contamination with these specific bacteria. It also includes viruses, things like hepatitis A or the Norwalk-type viruses, and fungi that includes mold and yeast. The nice thing about this last category is those are more of a food quality issue than a food safety issue, but you do still need to prevent or limit the growth of those types of contaminants. So when we look at bacterial growth and survival, there are six different things that can affect whether a bacteria grows or whether it even survives. The three that we mostly focus on from a food processing standpoint include the acidity, the temperature, and the moisture of the product. Acidity can slow the growth of some bacteria, and more importantly, it can prevent the germination of Clostridium botulinum spores. This is the bacteria responsible for botulism poisoning, which can be a very serious and deadly foodborne illness. Things like vinegar, citrus juices, and tomatoes are on the acid side. You can see that red line, anything below that 4.6 cutoff, so you have most of your berries, things like grapes, citrus fruits, are going to be in that on the safe side of that 4.6 pH. Most of our vegetables, things like meat, dairy products, those tend to fall in the unsafe category or low acid foods. Temperature is another way we can limit bacterial growth. This can either be through treating our food product with heat to destroy any living bacteria. It can also be by holding that food product at a low temperature, such as under refrigeration or freezing storage, to prevent the bacteria from growing as quickly. The last aspect that I'm going to talk about is moisture. Specifically, I'm going to talk about water activity. So bacteria have to have water available to grow. Water activity is not a measure of how much moisture or water is actually present in your food. It's a measure of how much is available for those bacteria to use as they grow. When we add things like sugar or salt, we are actually lowering the water activity. Something like a jam or a syrup has a very high water content, but it also has so much sugar added that that water is no longer available to support bacterial growth. We can also remove water when we dry or dehydrate products to lower the water activity. There is a chart in these slides that has some examples of where different types of food products tend to fall on that water activity scale. And again, that important cutoff point is 0.85. This brings us to how the FDA categorizes some of these types of products you may consider processing. Exempt products are bottled and canned things that are refrigerated or frozen or have a water activity below 0.85. This also, we tend to lump in other types of products, even if they're not bottled or canned, that still fit those same requirements. Here you can see the specific portions, the sections of the Code of Federal Regulations that would apply to the processing of those products, and you would need to register as an FDA food processor. And then this slide, we have some examples of different types of exempt products. Some barbecue sauces fall into this category. If it's a recipe or a formulation where you have a lot of sugar or salt added, you're more likely going to be under that exempt category. The next level of regulation is the acid food regulations. These are canned or bottled foods that have a natural pH of 4.6. So they fall on that low side of the pH scale. We also have a subcategory called formulated acid that falls under this same regulatory structure, and that is a food where the majority of the components are low acid, so they are high acid, so they have a low pH, and there are 10% of the products that are low acid, or they have a higher pH. Examples of acid foods would include canned tomato products, vinegar and oil dressings. Typically with a salsa or any type of sauce, there's a higher amount of, say, onions and peppers that fall into that low acid category, and those do not fall into this acid food regulatory structure. The acidified foods is where most of those types of products will fall. There they have a natural pH of greater than 4.6, so for example, the onion or the pepper component. But you add acid, and that drops the pH below 4.6 so that that product is safe. This requires that a process authority test your product and write a letter detailing how it can be safely handled. And you do have to register with the FDA as an acidified food processor and submit quarterly filings documenting that you are processing that product correctly. Again, examples include salsa, things like pickled vegetables, mayonnaise, and certain types of vegetable juices. The low-acid food regulations, this is the most highly rated, regulated food category that we're going to talk about. Here we have a natural pH above 4.6, and there is no acid added during the processing. This would include things like canned green beans. This also requires a process authority. Review your process and approve it, and you, again, have to register as a low-acid food processor and submit quarterly filings showing that you are meeting those processing requirements. And then here's an example, some of the types of things that fall into the low acid category. So I've gone through that rather quickly. I do want to let you know that there is a more detailed curriculum available at our Diversified Agriculture website. Also, in terms of assistance with the Food Safety Modernization Act rules and how that specifically is going to affect your farm or the types of processing that you're interested in, I recommend that you reach out to your local extension offices. Currently, there is a lot of curriculum being developed at a national and regional level to address some of the issues and questions that we know both farms and food processors will have. And we are in the process of developing that and getting that through extension offices, through other state regulatory agencies to make sure that we're getting that correct and appropriate information for the type of situation you are in. And that's it. That's my last slide.
Okay, Karen, thank you very much. Think about local foods and any discussion of local foods without addressing the food safety issues is really important. Most important considerations, I think, as we go out on the labor extension program. So our last presentation today is by Shermaine Hardesty, and as per my earlier introduction, she's an extension economist in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at University of California, Davis, and serves as the director of the University of California Small Farm Program. She's responsible for research, education, and outreach programs related to alternative food marketing and cooperatives. So with that, Shermaine, stage is yours.
Most of the information I'm going to be presenting is based on a USDA AFRI project with Colorado State University, and that project team includes Martha Sullins. So our University of California Small Farm Program that I lead has a very active agritourism component. It's been going on for over 20 years, and Penny Leff is the current agritourism coordinator. We have been very fortunate to receive funding from Western Risk Management Education Program for our outreach efforts. So, and I've been doing a lot of research regarding local foods during the past 10 years, so I was delighted to have this opportunity to mesh the two topics together. Okay, will my slides advance? Is there a delay? Okay, great. Just an overview of the topics I'll be covering, so I'll explain more about the connection between agritourism and local foods, then describe and define agritourism, and then get into some details of the characteristics of agritourism operations. Okay. Advance? Delay? Okay. Agritourism is defined as any income generating activity on a working farm or ranch. So that's a critical, bolded statement there about the working farm or ranch. You have to have a farm or a ranch that's in progress, actually producing food before we consider it agritourism. And agritourism involves a very, very broad range of activities, as you can see on that list. So next, I just wanted to say that agritourism connects basically the 98% of our population with our 2% of the producers, of the population that are producers. And what we're doing then is it's basically a know your farmer, kind of know your food kind of a theme there, because there's so many people who are getting interested in know their producers. And oftentimes we have adults that are very interested in where their food comes from, so they get involved with going to some type of a agritourism operation. and oftentimes they make it a family affair, and they'll bring their kids or their grandkids. We also have school field trips, and Martha mentioned farm to school, and that's a lot of the farm to school programs have scheduled school field trips to farms. And then I even brought my Girl Scout troop once, they were 10-year-olds at the time, to pick blueberries. But they complained about the prickliness of the blueberry plants, so I probably should have taken to them a U-pick strawberry operation instead. Okay, I see the slide here that's got the agritourism operations, a map in California. The purple spots are wineries. We include wineries that have tasting rooms and vineyards adjacent to them as part of our agritourism operations. We do have a lot of wineries here showing up on this map. The gold-colored dots are the more agricultural and ranching types of operations that offer some form of agritourism as well. Next, we've got the map of Colorado, and there again you see some clusters of agritourism operations. Colorado doesn't have as many operations, but there are the noticeable clusters, and the darker the green, the more operations there are. And they also include a lot of nature tourism operations and give the tourists an opportunity to watch wildlife. Next. Okay, so where are we generating revenues for agritourism? What kinds of activities are the most popular? Well, for both the states, you see that direct sales are the most common way. And, of course, that will include consumers going to the farm to just buy at a farm stand the apples or strawberries that are already been picked, or they can do U-pick as well. And also included in that direct sales would be those, what Karen was mentioning, the value-added foods. So you have the farmers that take the time to make their jams and jellies, and they're also available to be sold year-round. So it's a great way of expanding their income sources. For the rest of these activities, we kind of have a difference of the breakouts in the pie chart. Accommodations are a pretty common revenue source for agritourism in Colorado, 14%, but only 6% in California. The same for the outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, bird watching. That's big in Colorado, but not so much in California. Then in California, we have more educational activities for kids or adults. And so I mentioned the school visits already, but we also have adults taking classes, like they can take a class in jam making or another form of cooking, and that would be considered agritourism on a farm. Then we also have pretty high popularity of entertainment and special events. You've got pumpkin patches and corn mazes. Our local big event is the Hose Down Festival at the end of the harvest. And my own personal special event that I took part in last summer was my niece's wedding was held at a ranch up north just by Mount Shasta. And I had the privilege of picking up cow patties before the wedding so that people didn't have to walk on them. Very hands-on kind of experience there. Next, have the number of days that our agritourism operations are open. And you can see that there's a fair number that are open virtually all year round. And in particular, with California having 36% of its operations in that 251 days to 365 days, a lot of that is our wineries. For Colorado, you see that the peak category is the 101 to 250 days, and that's also, you know, those are hardworking people. They're spending a lot of time not only producing crops and livestock, but they're also operating a agritourism operation. So then you have the very small percentage there on the other end of the chart with 10 days or less, and I would say a lot of those would be your seasonal pumpkin patches, the corn mazes, perhaps even Christmas tree farms. Looks like my slides are not advancing. Okay. In terms of the number of visitors for our operations, this pie chart shows for California and Colorado combined, 40% are actually have between 200 and 1 and 1,000 visitors. So that's a fair number of visitors. That's the largest category. And then the groups that have over 1,000, the purple and the gold and the red and turquoise slices, they add up to 37%. So there is some fairly big operations, very active operations. Then we have that small green and blue sector, so with the 50 or less being 13%, I'm assuming that a lot of those may be just getting started with their agritourism operation, or there also could be a very expensive dude ranch stay that generates a lot of revenue without having to have a whole lot of visitors. Next. So we also need to know, how do these agritourists find out about these various agritourism operations? The biggest source is that word of mouth. It's kind of what you'd expect, but there's a lot of that, especially for the local types of activities. So that's a very important message, I think, to pass on to the agritourism operators, is to encourage that type of communication once they have their satisfied customers. The second most popular mechanism is websites, and that's an obvious one for us. And then next we have a more general social media. And fourth we have Yelp or TripAdvisor as another form of social media, especially being called out. So you can see that the overall social media is a very important and relatively inexpensive mechanism for getting agritourists informed about their opportunities. And then we have the more traditional sources, the direct mail, and tourism guides, and road signs even, and just the basic sign, highway sign, or sign outside the business. All different ways to promote the business. Okay, next we go on to where do the agritourism operations generate the most revenue. So this is important because we know that the reason for agritourism basically is to generate additional income for the farm or the ranch. And, this then gives them a way to diversify their income sources and can stretch out the number of months that a farming operation is able to generate revenue. We see here that the peak on these charts is between the 5,000 and 25,000 category for gross revenues from their agritourism operation. And that just tells me that there's a lot of opportunity for agritourism to grow. We can see also that we've got under the less than $5,000 revenue categories that makes up 21% of Colorado and 25% of California as well. So there again, you do have that great potential. Then on the other end, you've got the $1 million plus categories, and you can see that there's a significant opportunity to generate quite a bit of revenue. And in particular, you've got 8% of the Colorado operations and 5% of the California operations in that category. Next, we'll see about the profitability. So let's look at the box on the left for direct sales. And you see for direct sales that you've got the purple slice of the 2,500 to 25,000 as being the most heavy generating category. And then we've got for agritourism, for the accommodations, very surprising, the larger income categories there or profit categories there seem to be very profitable. We go on to entertainment and events, and again, you can generate, you've got a bulk of these operations generating over $25,000 in profit during the year. And the diversified operations, those would be the ones that are combining, say, direct sales with entertainment or accommodation. There you've got them in that 2,500 to 25,000 category. So we'll move on next to the set challenges that our agritourism operations face, and that's important to know about. We did, when we did the survey, we allowed them to make to have multiple responses. So you'll see that there's several categories that are fairly high in terms of being identified as a challenge. So we see for Colorado, there are more internal challenges. Their biggest challenge is 68% of them said management time and expertise, and then their marketing, and then financial capital access. Now, California is a little different. When we look down at the darker, the olive green bars for them, we see that state and local regulations were identified by 61% as being very challenging. And then we go to the city and county permitting and zoning, again, regulations. And then they say that we've got management time and expertise is also a challenge for about 50% of them. So in the case of California, we do have more regulations because it's a more mature industry in California. We've had regulations related to the wine industry in the Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino areas for many years, and now the other areas of California that have gotten involved in wine tourism have also developed regulations for their visitations. We also have lots of regional farm trails groups that support their members. Moving on here then, we can talk about the age of the agritourism business. So you can see that the 20 and more years that we call the veteran operations, and oftentimes these are not the same operators that have been doing it for the 20 years. They've passed it down generations of their family to get to that point. We also have the biggest group as what we call the established operations. They've been operating for between 5 and 19 years. In both cases, the states are very similar in those their age of operations. And we do have about a quarter of our operations in both states being under 5 years, and I certainly expect that category to grow in the future. So moving on here, talk about the education level of our agritourism operations. When we did this survey, I was very, very surprised. We have a very educated group of agritourism operators, as you can see from this chart. So on the far end, you've got people with advanced degrees operating their agritourism operations, and even with an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, that's the biggest group in both states. So overall, we do have 78% of the operators in California and 78% of the operations in Colorado and 72% of the operations in California having an associate's degree or more. And then we've only got less than 10% in both states having a high school degree or less. And it seems to me that agritourism, because it's combining agriculture with the other aspects of marketing and hospitality, requires a very complex and demanding activity. So therefore, in a sense, I shouldn't be surprised that we do require that the profession itself requires a high level of education. Next, we'll go on and talk about the future plans for these health operations. And what we see here is, despite the fact, or maybe because of their relatively low profit levels, most of the agritourism operations are planning to expand, as you can see from this chart. So we only have 30% saying that they want to remain about the same size, and less than 10% are planning to shrink or actually close up. So again, this looks like a very promising opportunity for many farms and ranches, despite the regulatory challenges and despite their constrained management time and limited management expertise. So what I see is that these agritourism operators are willing to take a risk in order to reduce their overall risk for their farming operations. And finally, wrapping up here, the prospects, we definitely see this growing interest in local food and how it's led to many farms and ranches creating agritourism operations to improve or expand that farm-to-fork experience. And also what they're doing by connecting with their consumers on the farm is that they're building the knowledge base about agriculture in our urban populations, and that, you know, that's basically influencing the voting public to support agriculture. So there's a second, very important secondary effect there besides the personal benefit to the individual operation. We see that agritourism has a very broad range of offerings, and but most of them are generating revenues under $100,000, and we see that most of them are profitable, although very small profitable, and then they're planning to expand their operations. So here's just my contact information next, and I should also add that our website for the Small Farm Program, which is sfp.ucdavis.edu, has a lot, much information about agritourism, especially hands-on issues related to various operational issues. Thank you.
Okay, Charmaine, thank you very much. We're getting questions from domestics of all sizes about agritourism. They really appreciate your comments. Okay, I have one question I'd like to ask today to the participants. Go ahead and start with the first one. The first one I will, Martha, you're the first one I'm going to pick on here. Given the level of public investment in food hubs and local food systems over the last few years, how efficient and or sustainable are these in the long run?
Okay, well, thanks, George. That's a great question. And I think, you know, you point to a really important issue, and it's definitely, as we look at the requests for proposals and the guidelines for grant writing, that's something that USDA is really concerned about, too. Because what they are doing with grant and loan programs is trying to take some of the risk out of starting a business in, it's not uncharted territory, but there's a, you know, there's a lot of unknowns. You know, how do you develop a business that brings together these regional assets, creates a market mechanism, and is successful in the long run? And so there's definitely a lot of emphasis in the grant and loan programs on how sustainable these businesses will be, because we do see them coming into business, and then some of them are not sustainable because they don't have, you know, appropriate business plans. So I think, you know, in some areas we have seen really good progress where those businesses have been able to get to do good business consulting and develop really good planning mechanisms to help them create sustainable businesses. I think that's where, if they can link in with those types of community resources, I think that's where we see the best prognosis for sustain, you know, those investments helping to create sustainable businesses. And I think just as a last point too, I think there really needs to be the density of producers to make those businesses, you know, be profitable. There has to be the array of products available, as well as the market that's proximate enough to that aggregation center or, you know, distribution is feasible within that area, so that the, you know, there's a market for the products that's just not too distant.
Thank you very much, Martha. Hey, Karen, this question is for you. Martha indicated that the number of direct market farms are growing. However, their sales range between $5,000 and $10,000. What are the issues of exempting this group of producers?
So that's a very good question. What we see, at least, so some of the farmers that I've talked to here in Utah, we're looking at a lot of our people who are maybe doing farmers market. They're selling some produce, maybe through a co-op type situation to a local grocery store where that produce is aggregated. That $25,000 needs to be the total value of produce sales. Speaking with some of our economists here at Utah State University, we're looking at that $25,000 cap actually being quite low when you consider all of the possible outlets that a farmer has. We have reports that some people with even backyard gardens are going over that $25,000 a year cap that's mandated in the Food Safety Modernization Act quite easily within the course of 1 year. Now, this $25,000 is a rolling average, a three-year rolling average, so they do need to consider all of the sales over the most recent three-year period. In terms of someone that truly falls under that $25,000 cap, I think we would be looking at a small enough farm that they maybe wouldn't have some of the same issues with the agricultural water sources that a larger farm would. There are very strict limits on the amount of specific bacteria that can be in that agricultural water. And a lot of times we see people that are using maybe, they might be using some irrigation water, but it's something that's provided through a city or a local area that actually is subjected to water quality testing on a regular basis anyway. One of the biggest issues with those smaller producers is that the FDA did consider in setting that $25,000 limit was, do you know who you are buying that produce from? If there is a problem and it does make you sick, would the consumer be able then to turn around and identify exactly who it was that they purchased that from? And in looking at the numbers in terms of the sizes of farms and the number of farms that were below that threshold of $25,000, it was such a small percentage, and they were doing pretty much exclusively local sales, direct to consumer at a farmer's market or a farm stand. And so the FDA felt that that cap was an appropriate level, and the food safety issues that might follow as a consequence of anyone below that threshold not meeting certain water quality standards, that it would not be a large issue in terms of public health or safety.
Yeah, Karen, thanks a lot for that succinct summary of that question. Okay, Charmaine, I have one question for you, and actually a very important question. What are the liability issues agritourism operations need to address?
There are many liability issues that they need to address. One is that food safety issue. If anything is consumed, let's say that they have a farm stay program and they're serving breakfast or dinner, there's that issue. There's also the hazards that can be incurred. Let's say you've got a U-pick operation and you have your customers picking cherries on a ladder. You can see how that can turn into some bad news. You have kids being involved in petting animals in a gated area, but sometimes those animals get freaked out. There's all kinds of machinery on a farm, and if you have visitors that are wandering around, you have to warn them and make sure that they won't be touching and trying to operate the equipment. Or if you offer wagon rides, you're not going to have seat belts on that wagon ride, but a rider could potentially fall off. So for that, we definitely advise agritourism operators to get liability insurance, and oftentimes they're very surprised at how expensive it is, but we always emphasize that it's very important for them to protect themselves and their assets and to get that insurance.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, well, that's, can't give them a round of applause because we're a long distance away here, but thank you very much to Martha, Karen, and Charmaine for these really informative presentations today.
Click
my next slide here, hopefully. So we would like to hear from you, the listeners today, about what you'd like to hear from us. What topics would you like to have us offer in the future? Either send us an entry here or, contact one of the participants, which are one of the coordinators of this, if you will, about future programming. Really appreciate your input. For more information on the slide set and to access the recorded version of the webinar, you can visit our Ag and Uncertain Times website, which is listed below. You can also go onto our file share window here and click on each file that's listed if you would like to have a download of the materials that were presented today. So we have those available to you as well. And with that concludes our webinar for today, and we really appreciate all of the audience that participated in this, and certainly a great shout out to the presenters today for this outstanding webinar on local food. So with that, we'll be signing off. Thanks a lot.